Up to 2 Samuel chapter 4. You know, myself and Todd decided we would start tag teaming this Sunday afternoon in Wednesday's services. So we're going back and forth here in 2 Samuel. We'll be going back and forth in James on Wednesday night. The first thing I realized is I should have been paying attention. He's been preaching through 2 Samuel for about 6 months now. Like, man. But anyway, as I was considering this, I was reminded of 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 16, that all Scripture is breathed out by God. All Scripture is profitable or it's useful for correction, for training, that we may be complete, we may be equipped for every good work. So this whole Bible is made to complete us, you know, to make us fully equipped. And as you read Romans 15, verse 4, it says, "For whatever was written in the former days was written for our instruction, that we might have endurance, and through the encouragement of the Scriptures we may have hope." So according to that, the Scriptures are written for our instruction, and they're written for our encouragement. So as I prepared this, that's the two focuses I'm trying to have. I'm going to try to see how can we be instructed through this and how can we be encouraged through this lesson. You may wonder how I'm going to get there in 2 Samuel 4, but we'll see. And again, as we get to chapter 4, we need to remember where we are. You know, Israel has come up as a nation and asked the Lord for a king. They asked Samuel to give us a king, like all the other nations, one who would go out before us in battle, one who would fight our battles for us. Samuel, that displeased Samuel. But the Lord told Samuel, "Look, it's not you they rejected. They rejected me. They do not want me reigning over them." Same thing you see in the life of Jesus. So they had the whole book of 1 Samuel is really geared toward the reign of Saul. And at the end of 1 Samuel, Samuel dies on the battlefield. He dies alongside three of his sons. Samuel had four sons. The one son that was left was a man named Ishbosheth. We're going to read about him today. We've been reading about him for the last several weeks. But Saul also had two sons of a concubine named Rizpah. He had two sons by her. So we'll kind of touch all this as we get there. But there's a verse in 1 Samuel 31 that I think would be helpful I think it's going to answer a couple questions we'll get here in chapter 4. 1 Samuel 31, 7 says, "When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead." So when the men of Israel saw that Saul and his sons were dead, they abandoned their cities and fled. And the Philistines came and lived in them. So once their king Saul was dead and his three sons, they just became frightened and they fled. And I think that'll answer a couple questions here in chapter 4. But we see Abner had went to David to swear, to change his loyalty, to swear allegiance to David. And in his mind, he was going to bring all Israel with him. But actually, Israel had been wanting for some time past to make David their king. So Abner was really just getting ahead of the wagon, so to speak. Abner was really the one who had kept Israel from following David the whole time. He's the one who really took Ishbosheth and set him up on the throne. He was Ishbosheth, pretty much his sole supporter, or his biggest supporter, and his biggest source of power. So verses 1 through verse 4, he is really just going to lay the foundation for the rest of this chapter. So I'll read 1 through 4. "When Ishbosheth, Saul's son, heard that Abner had died at Hebron, his courage failed, and all Israel was dismayed. Now Saul's son had two men who were captains of raiding bands. The name of the one was Bana, the name of the other Rechab, sons of Ramon, a man from Benjamin from Beroth. For Beroth was also counted part of Benjamin. The Berathites fled to Gideon and have been sojourners there to this day. Jonathan, the son of Saul, had a son who was crippled in his feet. He was 5 years old when the news about Saul and Jonathan came from Jezreel. And his nurse took him up and fled. And as she fled in her haste, he fell and became lame. And his name was Mephibosheth. So we see right in the beginning here, verse 1, it's on the heels of Abner being put to death. Now, Abner had went to swear allegiance to David, and as he left, Joab, David's commander, frustrated that David had let the enemy come in and leave, chased him down, called him back, and then killed him. Stabbed him in the stomach, I think the Bible tells us. And so here, Ishbosheth heard that Abner had died. His only strength of power, his main supporter, was now dead. And it says his courage failed. That literally means to just release, just to become limp. He just lost all strength. Both physically, he lost strength, and emotionally, he lost strength. You know, and it says, then all Israel was dismayed. They were all terrified. They didn't know what was going to come. Like I said, Abner was his support and strength for the throne. But Ishbosheth had trusted in man to gain his position. Completely opposite of David. Ishbosheth trusted in man to gain his position. And Psalms 118 tells us it's better to take refuge in the Lord than to trust in man. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord. It's in Jeremiah. But all Israel was terrified. They were terrified. They were unable to oppose David. You know, they had already battled with David in chapter 2 and sustained a horrible defeat. They were unable to oppose him. And now their leader is dead. The leader's dead and their king is weak, so their fate seems more and more dim, more and more dismal. So Abner was the liaison, really, between Judah and Israel. He was the one who went to make this deal. And he ended up dying at the hands of David's men. Although David didn't support it, didn't desire it, and actually condemned it strongly in the last chapter. Their mediator is dead. And all that they're left with is a weak king. A very weak king. And then it goes on and it mentions these two men that were captains of his raiding bands. And it names these two men, Benaiah and Rechab, the sons of Ramon. Now there's not much known about this Ramon from Benjamin. You know, the name Ramon really isn't mentioned any other times in connection with this guy. In any other passage in the Bible, but in 2 Kings 5, we're told about Naaman, you know, who was healed from his leprosy. He actually would go and worship in the house of Ramon. You know, now, Ramon, there is a Syrian god. It's a Syrian deity, a Syrian little g god. Now, I'm not saying that the father here worshiped a Syrian god or served a pagan god. All I'm saying, he had the same name as a pagan god. And his sons were wicked men. David's going to call them that in verse 11. So he is the father of wicked sons, and he's named either after or similar to a pagan god, for what it's worth. And it talks about that these men were from Baruth, and Baruth was kind of part of Benjamin. Why is that important? I mean, what tribe was Saul from? Benjamin. This was family. These were the ones who should have been supporting him, right? If anybody was going to support King Saul, it should have been the Benjamites. He was one of their own. They were members of the tribe of Benjamin, as was Saul. They should have been more loyal to Ishbosheth. I mean, I guess if you're going to go against God, they should have been more loyal to Ishbosheth. They should have been following the Lord and serving David the whole time. But then when we get to this Mephibosheth in verse 4, and if as you're reading this, this just kind of seems out of place. It's out of context, it's not out of context, but it's not chronologically, it doesn't flow. It almost acts as a parenthesis here in verse 4. You know, but the point of this, there's a purpose behind the way the writer wrote this. It speaks about something that was written at the time of Saul's death. You see, Jonathan had a son who was crippled. And when news about Saul and Jonathan, Jonathan being his father, Saul being his grandfather, when news about his grandfather and father came, the nurse took him up and fled. Well, that happened some time back. So why are they bringing it up here? What they're bringing it up here for is to let us know that the next in line to the king was Mephibosheth. Saul had four sons. Three had died. One's left, Ishbosheth. He's fixing to be murdered. Spoiler alert, I guess. He's fixing to be murdered. And so the next in line is a young, lame, crippled boy. And he's incapable of serving the capacity of a king they wanted. He couldn't go out before them. He couldn't fight for them. He couldn't lead them in the battle. He was physically incapable of being their king. And he wasn't born this way. We're told how this accident occurred. It said that his nurse took him up and she fled in her haste. But why is she fleeing? You know, I think that's why I read that chapter 31 verse. They all fled. You know, when news about Saul and his sons, they all fled and left their cities, and they left their cities vacant, and the Philistines just came and lived in them. So she's just terrified, frightened, and ran. So, just a challenge here. I'm going to give you some facts and see if you can figure this out. It doesn't really tell us how old Mephibosheth is here in chapter 4 at Ishbosheth's death. But Mephibosheth was how old? 5. He was 5 when Saul died. When Saul died, they set David up as king over Hebron. David was not king over all of Israel until 7 years later. Then he became king over all Israel. So how old would Mephibosheth be here? Y'all are not good at math. He's 12. All right, so Mephibosheth is a 12-year-old, lame, crippled kid who cannot serve as king. So they don't have a descendant from the house of Saul to go and prop back up on the throne and start all over. They don't have that. Now again, Saul had 2 sons by a concubine named Rizpah. The concubine's name was Rizpah. His son's name was Armoni and Mephibosheth, a different Mephibosheth, not the same one here. I don't know why Jonathan would name his son Mephibosheth after he had a father named his, he had a brother named Mephibosheth, but he did. But the children of a concubine do not hold the same status. They just don't. They were not legitimate heirs to the throne. So the only heir to the throne of the house of Saul was this his grandson, this 12-year-old crippled kid, who was incapable. So at this point, and at this point, I wonder too if they even realize that Mephibosheth is alive. You know, because the nurse grabbed him up and fled. And you see, when we get to chapter 9, David actually asked the question, is there anyone left of the house of Saul? Is there anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake? And they go find Mephibosheth for him. So it's questionable if it's even known that Mephibosheth is alive at this point. But we see the author here, in my mind, is intentionally highlighting the weakness of the house of Saul. Which if you look back in chapter 3, look at verse 1. And David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul became weaker and weaker. They have a son, Ishbosheth, a puppet king, a weak king, who's set on the throne. He's upheld by Abner. Now Abner's dead. And all that's left is this crippled kid, Mephibosheth. But you see, we knew this was coming from way back in 1 Samuel 15. The Lord said he had torn the kingdom from Saul and gave it to David. So that's why his house was getting weaker and weaker and weaker. It was the Lord taking the kingdom from Saul and giving it to David. That's why David's house was growing stronger and stronger. Saul's house was growing weaker and weaker. So here I think we've been given the character, so to speak, Ishbosheth, Benaiah, Rechab, and it mentions Mephibosheth there in verse 4. Now we're fixing to have what I call the crime, or the story of chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. Now the sons of Ramon, the Barathite, Rechab and Benaiah, set out, and about the heat of the day they came to the house of Ishbosheth, as he was taking his noonday rest. And as they came into the midst of the house, as if to get wheat, and they stabbed him in the stomach. Then Rechab and Benaiah, his brother, escaped. When they came into the house, as he lay on his bed in his bedroom, they struck him and put him to death and beheaded him. They took his head and went by the way of the Arabah all night. And they brought the head of Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. Let's stop right there. So you see the strategy. So you have Rechab and Benaiah, these two sons of Ramon, and they're, by the way, Ishbosheth's captains of his raiding bands. They come in as he was taking his noonday rest. Apparently, this may have been his routine, the way it's written. It was just common. In the Septuagint, just as a footnote, the Septuagint adds that a woman was at the doorway of Ishbosheth's house, and she had fallen asleep. So she was there really threshing wheat or something, and she had fell asleep also. But it says they came in to get wheat. They came in at the heat of the day, in the middle of the day, at the time he was taking his noonday rest, and they went into the middle of the house to get wheat. Now, the reason they did that is, and it's still common today, it's a custom in the East to allow soldiers a certain amount of grain with their pay. They gave them a certain amount of wheat, they'd give them a certain amount of corn or whatever they had. They gave them a certain amount of grain alongside their pay. So coming in at this time may have been a little bit early, may have been a little earlier than usual, but it didn't create any suspicion. There was no suspicion there among the guards, if there were any guards. There was no suspicion as what was going on here. And it says they came in, if you look, as if to get wheat. They came in as if to get wheat. So this was deceitful. This was planned. This was deliberate. It's not like they got in there and some struggle happened or something. You know, they deceitfully, deliberately planned this. We're going to go in the middle of the day. They're going to assume we're there to get wheat for our soldiers. He's going to be asleep. You see the plan? You know, maybe, I don't know, but maybe they placed Ishbosheth's head in a bag. I don't know, or a sack, or something that resembled a grain when they escaped. They may have just toted it by the hair of his head, I don't know, but they escaped with his head. They cut off his head and escaped with it, and they ran all night. They ran, it says, by the way of the Arabah all night, which is about 30 to 50 miles. You know, Wendy ran a marathon, I think it took her, what, 12 hours? No? But anyway, they ran all night. They were frightened, they were scared out of their wits. So, you almost, in a sense, you see the sarcasm that's being mentioned here. You know, you see these are captains, these are leaders, these are warriors of the tribe of Benjamin. They're family. They were close to Ishbosheth, someone he may have trusted. They sneak in while he's asleep, as usual. They kill him in his own home, in his own bed, and they run all night. You see the sarcasm as the writer is somewhat describing these brave, quote-unquote, warriors, right? You don't have to be brave to kill someone while they're asleep. You know, and they're wanting, I guess like any warrior, to be described as a mighty man. But it doesn't take a mighty man to kill someone while they're asleep. Actually, if you remember the story of Barak and Deborah, you know, as they're on the attack, Sisera's on the run. Sisera goes into the tent of a woman named Jael, goes to sleep, and the woman, Jael, takes a tent peg and drives it through his temple, killing him. So a woman can kill you while you sleep. It doesn't take a mighty man to do that. You know, in this day. You know, you're not courageous, you're a coward. That's what you're kind of getting here. You're not a leader. You're not a captain. You're not someone to be trusted. You are, as David notices, wicked, evil men. David picks right up on it. So let's move on to verse 8, or the rest of verse 8. They brought the head to Ishbosheth to David at Hebron. And he said to the king, "Here is the head of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. The Lord has avenged my lord, the king, this day on Saul and on his offspring." So these brave warriors, they bring the head to David. Now we're fixing to see their plan the whole time. This was their plan. These men literally were opportunists. They saw Ishbosheth's power. They saw his reign coming to an end. So they decided they would quicken that by killing Ishbosheth and running to David as if they were some kind of loyal supporters and doing him a favor, protecting him, taking out the enemy. You see? Saul, your enemy, who sought your life. David, we saved your life. You don't have to worry. You don't, no more sleepless nights, David. We took care of this problem for you while he was sleeping. But now I think we're fixing to get, in my mind, to some instruction. As I said earlier, I was going to try to bring this out to where we had some instruction and some encouragement. So when these men, these two brothers, Benaiah and Rechab, when they were planning this, did they seek the Lord? No. Did they inquire of the Lord? No. But just real quick, if you'll notice the contrast between a godly man and these wicked men, if you'll turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 2, I'll show you a couple places real close by so we don't have to turn far. 2 Samuel chapter 2, verse 1. After this, David inquired of the Lord, Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? You see, David asking the Lord, what should I do? Get over in chapter 5. I'll pick up in verse 18. The Philistines had come and spread themselves out in the valley. You know, they had come up against Israel, going to attack Israel, and David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up against the Philistines?" Look in verse 22, chapter 5. The Philistines came up yet again and spread themselves out. What did David do? He went and he inquired of the Lord. Look, I dug on this. There is hardly any character in all the Bible that's mentioned inquiring of the Lord, seeking the Lord, praying to God more than David. David sought God and inquired of God more than any other character in the Bible. And you wonder why it said of him, David was a man after God's own heart. That's why. He consistently sought God in prayer. He was consistently seeking God. That's what David did. David wasn't as these men. He wasn't planning and strategizing. David was trusting and following. It's a big difference. He was trusting in God's way. And Isaiah 55, verse 8 tells us, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, and my ways are not your ways." Right? But God is saying there, look, his thoughts are not like man's thoughts. My ways are not man's ways. But the closer we live to God, the more Christ-like we should be. Our thoughts cannot be like the world. Our ways can't be the world's ways. So I thought about this, and I was actually on a recent, more, you know, a local example of this. I was thinking about Jacob West, that is. This is good. This ain't going to be bad. But anyway, as he had a position open to him of becoming a judge, what did he do? Prayed about it. And I know he prayed about it because he come to church and asked the church to help him pray about it. Right? But you see, what would the world have said? Man, that's more money. That's a more prestigious job. What are you waiting for? See, that's the advice the world would have gave. You know, maybe even some, for lack of better words, immature Christians would say, "What are you waiting for? God's opened that door for you, Jacob." But Jacob just wanted to be sure that wasn't his own ambition. That maybe it wasn't the devil opening that door for him, causing him to seek his career, seek after money, seek after materialism, and leave God behind. He was waiting on God, knowing that God would answer his prayer. Make sure it was God who opened that door for him. I thought it was a great example, brother. I really did. But anyway, and you see, you know, if you're wondering about doors being opened, David has an opportunity to strike Saul. Two times, Saul is in his hands. One time in the cave, Saul's in the cave, unarmed. And David's men are sitting there chirping in his ear the whole time. This is the moment that God told you about. David, you're going to be king. The Lord's told you that. The only thing standing in your way of being king right now is Saul. And he's here. He's seeking your life. It's only self-defense, David. Strike him now. This is from God. But David didn't do it. He was afraid to lift his hand against the Lord's anointed. We have the same thing when he's asleep. Saul's asleep with all his troops scattered around him, and his people are again in his ear. David, this is it. Let me strike him. If you won't do it, I'll do it. I'll strike him this time. I won't have to strike him but one time. One time, David. This is the moment God was telling you about. This is it. But David didn't do it. David's ways were not their ways. You see? Let's move on to verse 9. But David answered Rechab and Benaiah's brother, the sons of Ramon, the Berethite. Remember, they were saying, David, we've saved you. The man who sought your life, we saved you, David. And David answers them, as the Lord lives, the Lord who has redeemed my life out of every adversity. Who does David see as saving him? I mean, really, that's what he's saying. I don't need your wicked hands. The Lord has promised this to me. He's going to deliver it to me. He's the one who has spared me. See, but they were trying to spin and twist this murder into their own, you know, humble plot so they could get a seat at the king's table, so to speak. Your enemy, David, they sought your life. But David saw God as the one who delivered it. He didn't need their wicked hands killing innocent men to attain the throne. He was promised a throne. He didn't need it. Verse 10. And so David said, basically, the Lord has redeemed my life out of every adversity. When one told me, behold, Saul is dead, and he thought he was bringing me good news, I seized him, and I killed him at Ziklag, which was the reward I gave him for his news. I bet their heart had to drop. They come today with this good news in the head of Ishbosheth. And he says, hey, you know the guy that came to me with Saul? Bringing me good news about the death of Saul, what I did to him? I killed him. Man. Talking about a twist of irony. That one backfired big time. We see. So they believe they're bringing him good news, and David's going to remind them how he treats those who bring him good news when it's by wicked means. Verse 11. How much more, you know, if I've killed the guy who thought he was bringing me good news about the death of Saul, how much more when wicked men have killed a righteous or an innocent, that word could be innocent, have killed an innocent man in his own house, on his own bed, shall I not now require his blood at your hand and destroy you from this earth? So they must have informed David that they struck him in his house, on his bed. How else did he know this? I mean, why would they brag about that? Would they brag that they were some kind of tacticians? Like, Lord, we waited on them to go to sleep, and we pretended we was getting weed, and then we went in there and we struck him. Then we snuck off with his head. You want us serving you? I'm amazed that they seem to just present this information. But David knew about it. And so Ishbosheth occupied the throne. And David's saying, look, you killed an innocent man in his house, on his bed. You killed him. And he occupied the throne, but he's not called anointed, if you notice that. You know, David specifically would talk about Saul as the anointed one of God, or the anointed. How are you afraid? How are you not afraid to raise your hand against the Lord's anointed? He said it consistently, but here he doesn't call Ishbosheth anointed because he wasn't. But he was a king, and he didn't deserve to be treated and murdered the way he was. So I guess I'll go on and read verse 12. And David commanded his young men, and they killed him, and they cut off their hands and feet and hanged them beside the pool of Hebron. They took the head of Ishbosheth and buried it in the tomb of Abner at Hebron. So basically, David killed these men, chopped off their hands and their feet, maybe their hands because those are the tools they used to murder him, and their feet because they were swift to shed blood and ran with the head all night. And he made an example of them. He hung them by the pool at Hebron for all of Israel to see. But, you know, there's some encouragement in this as I was thinking about it. You know, there's no power that can overcome the plan and purpose of God. None. That's encouraging. Abner, although he knew the Lord had swore that David would be king over all Israel, he still tried to set up and establish the house of Saul. Abner was still trying to do that. But no power could overcome what God had promised was going to happen. And it would not be set up through injustice, by wicked hands, by scheming, by plotting, by wicked means. The death of Abner, nor the death of Ishbosheth, neither of these two events happened as a result of David. And another thing we've got to keep in mind is God is faithful. He's trustworthy. You know, he had promised the throne to David. But let me back up. He had promised Abraham a son. But Abraham seemingly grew impatient, either Abraham or his wife, and we see the whole event with the handmaiden Hagar trying to rush it. We see Jacob and Esau. You know, God had already said, the older shall serve the younger. But what do? When they go to their father, they try to trick him into doing something that God already said was going to happen. Right? We have the same thing here. The Lord has promised the kingdom to David. And we have all kinds of advice or advisors being given to David on kill the king, take the throne, kill the king, take the throne. And David's refusing. David is patiently waiting and trusting God that God will deliver. You don't have to make it happen. If he's promised it to you, he's going to bring it to pass. David had to wait roughly 15 to 20 years to reign after he was anointed. He was anointed as king, and he served a wicked king for 15 to 20 years faithfully, waiting on God to fulfill his promise of setting him up over the house of Israel. So just notice the patience and trust that David has in the Lord. As men around him are rushing God, using wicked hands in an attempt to cause things to happen sooner, David is patiently waiting, patiently trusting God. So we need to be more like David. David here is a good example of seeking God. You know, knowing we need to be seeking him all the time. Not just, you know, when as our last resort, which is usually pretty common. And one more thing I wanted to mention, and I read this from a Dale Ralph Davis. He was talking about how these men came to King David with Ishbosheth's head in their hand, and it said they come with blood on their hands, but theology on their lips, expecting the latter would magically bleach the former. And his point there is, these men come to David with murderous hands, but they're pretending they're doing the will of God. You know, Saul, your enemy, David, we've killed Saul, your enemy, and now this throne is all yours. You know, they're using theology in a way to attain their own wicked ways, or they're attempting to. They have theology on their lips and blood on their hands. And we study theology. We love theology. Now, we can misuse theology and oftentimes do, but one of them I was thinking was the eternal security. You know, a lot of times you'll hear people say, oh, no one can pluck me out of the Father's hands, and who can separate us from the love of God, and all these things. and they're using it as just an excuse to live outside the will of God. They're using an excuse to just indulge themselves in any sinful act they want to. That's using theology on your lips and blood on your hands, so to speak. But we can also do it with the sovereignty of God. We say things like, I know the Lord is sovereign. He's going to save those whom he's going to save. And we use that as an excuse to sit on our hands and do nothing. Right? Instead of sharing the saving power of Jesus Christ, teaching, strengthening young believers, helping them mature in the faith, we just lay all that on theology. Well, what's going to happen is going to happen. And we just sit on our hands. We have theology on our lips, blood on our hands. That's what you see these men doing here. So, all right, I'm going to pay attention next week as Todd does chapter 5, so I'm more prepared when I get to chapter 6. But nonetheless, you would please stand. Brother Lance, would you please?